listening to Highland Radio. Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to the weekend edition this Saturday. Coming up on the programme, we've our latest crime update with Garda Sergeant Paul Wallace. We ask how foreign nationals or the new Irish feel they're being treated in our county. There's a special feature on Letterkenny General Hospital 1 year on from the devastating floods. A major youth bike race starts later today. We speak to its director, and Martin tells how his 17-year-old daughter couldn't get a provisional licence because she didn't have a utility bill. We're back on the streets getting your views on a range of topics and your calls, comments and requests. More than welcome. On the phone this morning, you can call Yvonne on 07491 25000. You can text us on 086 77 00 555, or tweet the programme at Greg Hughes 2. Okay, a mix of questions we asked out on the streets today, some serious, some not so. A lot of reaction to one where we asked, when are you too old, if at all, for a tattoo or to wear skinny jeans or a miniskirt and clothes like that? Or if you get in touch with us. Also, well, the summer's officially over. Apparently yesterday, the last day of summer, would you believe? But we are in the middle of a bank holiday weekend. So if you want to suggest something for people to do this bank holiday weekend, the quirkier the better, of course. You can text us on 086 77 00 555 or 07491 25000 if you wish to ring the programme. And calls, comments, suggestions, more than welcome. And if there's something you think we should be talking about as well, get in touch and we'll see what we can do. Joined in studio today to look at the newspapers today, reflect on the news of the last few days, it's Claudia Kennedy. A very good morning to you, Claudia.
Good morning, Greg. Delighted to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. People will know you, I suppose, more broadly. You were a unsuccessful, unfortunately, candidate in the recent local elections. But tell us a bit more about yourself, if you want. I mean, you're heavily involved in Fianna Fáil, so I'm here now to counteract this pro Fianna Fáil if it comes out. And you can't hide it. But anyway, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, Greg, I'm a full-time secondary school teacher in Finn Valley College in Stranorlar. I teach English and Religion and also SPHE. I am very heavily involved in politics. I'm on the Fianna Fáil National Executive, which is the ruling body of the party. And it's a great opportunity to meet with our leader, meet with the TDs, our senators, and bring up the issues that are important in our own area. So I will be very vocal on issues here for rural Donegal. And we have monthly meetings in the Dáil. So it's a great platform to get things done, and things are done, and there does be great debate. And I think the big thing is queries do be delivered on for people. That's the most important aspect that I see in my role on the Fianna Fáil National Executive.
One of the feelings people have a lot with politics is this disconnect from people on the ground, you know, me, you, everyone out there, and how our views, our feelings and what's bothering us gets to the top tables, be it the opposition or indeed the government. You would be a big advocate of you know, improving that connection, would you?
Oh, absolutely, Greg. And I think in terms of the way that parties communicate with their members, communicate with the public, that really needs to be improved upon. Even in terms of social media, even them coming into interviews like this today, holding their clinics, being available to people, being available on the phone. And I think it's very important as well that when they're talking with people, they're on that level with people and that they're honest with people, Greg. And if they can't deliver on an issue or a query, they need to say that they can't, as opposed to promising the sun, moon and stars and not delivering and leaving that person, I suppose, well, very angry with the system. And also, I think when we look at the Constitutional Convention and the way they've held a number of open forums and bringing the public in, I think that was wonderful, where you got really a think tank opportunity with the public, where you're hearing the real issues of real people on the ground. I think that's vitally significant.
In fairness, there was a lot of cynicism towards that, but it has been acted upon. We are seeing changes. We're seeing referendums coming up pretty much that came directly from that forum. Last week, there was a survey out that suggested, or at least it was an opinion that was suggested, that, you know, a lot of people that voted in the last general election, particularly those who voted for the first time, are probably not going to vote again because, you know, there is, as I say, this disconnect, particularly with the youth and the amount of attention is given to youth issues. Can you understand that?
I can understand that. And from being a teacher, I think it's very important as well to connect with our youth. For example, we teach the SPE up to junior cert. I think that's something that we could extend right up to the leaving certificate.
You teach the
CSPE curriculum.
What's that?
So that's where you're looking at all the issues of the day, particularly our political system. Mm. You're educating our youth on the Seanad, on the Dáil, on current issues that are important to them. So, for example, they learn about the importance to vote. They're learning about their different political parties and what they represent. They're learning how you actually go in and vote, Greg. A number of citizens don't actually know, do you put a number one or do you tick in different types of elections or referenda? So it's about educating our people and connecting with them. And I think that needs to begin within our education system and extending that right up to the leaving certificate. The other thing I would say as well, when we're coming up to an election, there needs to be advertisements from our national broadcasters on how to vote and really informing our people on the different political parties, what they represent in short, snappy advertisements.
Well, in fairness, that's the job of the Election Commission.
It is indeed. But still, I do think the Broadcasting Authority has a role to play in that. Mm. I think that we see very long, lengthy debates that people get bored of, and we hear the sound bites from different political parties pushing their own agendas. I think the public can see through that. But I do think there needs to be more information given to the public in a shorter, snappier, more effective manner, as opposed to very long debates where you lose the public in a lot of sense.
And I think, though, a lot of that is that politicians, a lot of politicians live in ivory towers, and they talk, particularly national politicians, they talk about issues that they don't fully understand, perhaps, in that, you know, do they truly know the struggles of the people out there, what it's like not to be able to feed your children, what it's like not to be able to pay your mortgage, and I think that that's something that needs to be addressed, that the language that's used by, as I say, particularly national politicians, is actually relevant to people on the ground, and that they understand also that, you know, this, you have Dublin, you have Galway, you have Cork, but you do have rural areas, not least Donegal, and mm-hmm. that they can't talk up the economy when people are listening to the radio in Donegal. They're listening to this information coming from Dublin, and they're going, what are they on about a property boom? Half the houses are lying empty around here.
And what I would say to that point, Greg, is that we can't just say that all politicians are disconnected. There are some that are very much connected, use public transport, hold their weekly clinics, meet the public. They're very connected. They have families, they have children. They know what they're going through and with the daily struggles as well. So I don't think you can just say that it's the same for all politicians. I do agree there is a certain proportion of them that are disconnected. That might be to do with the amount of wages that they are paid and all the rest that goes with that. And some are in an ivory tower. Not all are, though. I want to stress that, but it's very, very important. And a lot of our public representatives are very hardworking. They're very dedicated. It's a 24/7 job where you are dealing with the public and some very serious issues and trying to help people as well.
Before we get into the newspapers, did you spell Stranola incorrectly on your election posters?
That was due to the printing company.
But that did happen.
That did happen. Yes, that is correct.
Well, listen, I know hope you have a sense of humour, but a listener did point out that you are a teacher. And
well, to be honest, Greg, we were left with a very short time, four weeks into the campaign. I'd rang my printing company. I'd given them all the information. It was a very quick turnaround of 48 hours. It was literally get the posters, get them up. Part of my team collected them and they were put up.
Well,
and
look, I think the comment was made tongue in cheek in any case.
Yes.
And it's history at this point. The national newspapers today, what's jumping out for you from them?
Well, let's start off here with the Irish Times. And the first story is the Gaza conflict escalates, a soldier is seized. And this story, I think, has really resonated with us here in Ireland. It has been shocking. It has been very emotional to see the scenes of what has been happening in Gaza. So the planned three-day ceasefire ends in Ireland after Israeli officer is captured by Hamas. So the conflict in Gaza has actually intensified yesterday after the capture of an Israeli soldier drew a furious response from Israel and caused the collapse of the planned three-day ceasefire just hours after it had begun.
And that's a really important point because a couple of people said to me yesterday when one of the lead stories on the news was one soldier being captured, and they're saying, well, why is one soldier being captured the headline and we have so many innocents in Gaza dying? But it was in the context of this ceasefire, and the reaction that Israel may take to avenge the capturing of this soldier. So that's why that became such a big issue. It's not just there was this feeling, well, this is one life, but obviously in a war situation it has
Yes.
Ramifications.
Yes, and I'm very delighted that you pointed out it's in a ceasefire situation. And I think what we're looking at here is the catastrophic loss of life, and that has to be condemned. Now, we know during the week the Shannoth was recalled. We had a debate. Deputy Charlie Flanagan came in to discuss Ireland's approach to this situation internationally. But I think one thing that has really resonated here with us as Irish people is the fact that Ireland abstained from a UN vote to establish a commission of inquiry into the human rights violations within Gaza and to condemn Israel. And I think that's something that the public are finding very difficult to understand and to see. Why did Ireland do that? Now, the Shannon debated. Minister Flanagan came in to give his point of view. But for us here, from an Irish perspective, when we see those deplorable scenes of innocent lives being slaughtered, we just cannot understand how Ireland would take that approach.
Well, the bottom line is from the government's perspective, from Minister Flanagan's perspective, he believed the wording of, what is it, was it a motion, was it, or I don't know what the exact terminology was, it didn't recognise Hamas's role in the conflict, the fact that they are firing missiles indiscriminately mm-hmm. into Israel as well, and that the country didn't want to put its name to something that attributed all the blame to one side, i.e. Israel. Now, that's not going to settle with a lot of people, but perhaps there is, you can see an argument there. Maybe this is an excuse that was come up with retrospectively. But
I would believe so. I think when you look at the fatalities on either side, you're looking at 1,500 Palestinians, civilians that have been targeted by Israelis.
But every single Hamas rocket fired into Israel is fired into Israel with the intent to kill. Now, the fact that it doesn't, does that make it any less of a crime? And I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Oh, absolutely. And I suppose the other side of that is Hamas would say that they are actually targeting specific military bases, whereas Israeli fire rockets are coming directly into a very small area with 1.8 million people. These are indiscriminate killing of innocent citizens. And when you look at the fatalities on either side, what is going on in Palestine is a war crime. Just the fatalities. It's absolutely deplorable.
So, I mean, another thing that's hard to get one's head around is this was discussed in America recently, and senators voted overwhelmingly to support Israel, to indeed increase the arms. I mean, the situation is the US holds arms in Israel. America has access to them if they need them for an operation in that area. But also, the Israeli armed forces have access to this. Why is this not? Why are the people of America so supportive of Israel? Is it a lack of information? Is it biased media?
I think if you look at the power that that Israeli section would have within American society, they're extremely powerful. We had Senator John Kerry, who did an interview during the week and was caught off mic saying that America needed to do more within Israel. And he really pinpointed the fact that America's not doing enough. And we've had Barack Obama, who has talked about this last night, who called for unconditional release of the soldier who was taken by Hamas militants in a confrontation in which two other Israeli soldiers were killed. Now, I think it's basically due to the amount of power Israelis, Jewish people hold within American society, hold within American politics. I think that's a big component of this. And I think it's simply perhaps down to votes.
And there's that situation whereby, you know, there's a massive campaign, particularly online, to get shops to stop supplying goods from Israel. You know, a lot of its food mm-hmm. produce. In reality, 2.8% of Israeli GDP is agriculture. The rest of it is everyone listening today with a radio, with a computer, with a telephone. Mm-hmm. If they get on a plane, most of that technology comes out of Israel. So if you actually wanted to have an efficient boycott of it, you have to send back your Samsungs, your iPhones and your Mac computers, because a lot of the technology contained within comes from and provides the revenue to Israel.
It does indeed. And I think looking down the road towards the future, there has to be some sort of solution to this, because I think the loss of life is absolutely horrendous. And I think the blockading of Gaza is a huge issue. And I think that's something that needs to be addressed. And I think from an American perspective, they need to be involved in terms of a ceasefire, in terms of negotiations, in terms of helping that whole process to go forward. But I think something needs to be done. I think the European community needs to be more vocal and more active and to have a more robust response. But particularly America holds a lot of the cards. We know that they're in support of Israel, but I think they have a duty in terms of moral duties and values to be involved and to look at a ceasefire and working towards the future. And I think the blockading of Gaza is the core component of that ceasefire.
086 77 00 555 is the text line. 0749 125 000. We're in studio with Claudia Kennedy. Obviously, the Gaza issue, quite rightly so. Ironically, now the Ukrainian issue is slipped off the agenda to some extent, yet we have increased sanctions against Russia. The international community more than happy to flex their muscles towards Russia, while Israel are held up in great regard by many, it seems, many major countries in the world. Moving on, what else is catching your eye in the papers, Claudia?
So I'm going to move on next to the Irish Independent. And on the front page of the Independent today, we read, Bank of Ireland to stir up market with sale of 1,500 homes. So Bank of Ireland is putting 1,500 homes on the market and making 250 million available for new home construction projects. Now, that's quite positive, Greg, if it's nationally spread out geographically. So if you're looking at the rural areas and the urban areas and you're just looking at creating an economy and getting people back to work. However, this is quite controversial because you're looking at a number of these homes that would have been repossessed. So they will be sold at a shorter price. And we know that there's a lot of emotion and a lot of difficulties for families that have had to leave their family homes. Now, one of the most interesting thing in this, I think, is that controversially, around 1 in 6 of these houses to be sold have been repossessed, as we've said. But in addition, are so-called voluntary sales of homes by borrowers in deep arrears. Sales of buy-to-let properties in the hands of receivers and houses being completed in previously stalled development schemes. So will the demand be there? Will it be nationally spread out that you can actually look after people in rural Ireland? Or are we just still going to have this bubble within Dublin? And that actually has not been looked at here by Bank of Ireland. Now, as I say, if it is going to bolster up the market, if it's going to create jobs, if it's going to help the economy, that is wonderful. But I hope we're not going to get into this situation of a bubble property situation that we have in Dublin, which is currently there, and adding to that.
Well, we have a three, people talk about a two-tier property market. It's a three-tier. We have Dublin, which is in a bubble, and Endicani can deny it isn't. And I have to say, as soon as I heard him deny there was a bubble, my mind went straight back to Bundoran, and your former leader, Bertie Ahern, made some very controversial remarks, but he said, stop talking it down, everything's fine. And I heard Endicani kind of was, I felt like, well, I hope you're not, that's not going to come back and bite you, Mr. Kenny. But you have Dublin, then you've got the community belts, which there is some supply, but, you know, that's running out.
Yes.
But then you have other areas. We're tossing, I think we tossed 40 ghost estates over the last year around the country. This, the government, what their challenge is, surely, and any subsequent government, is to ensure that the recovery is nationwide. And that would mean that you have to have positive discrimination or, you know, positive initiatives outside of the urban centres.
Absolutely, I think it's hugely important. And for us living in Donegal, we are looking at this daily. As you're talking about the ghost estates, we're talking about young people that cannot get mortgages, we're talking about people that can perhaps not build a house on their own land. And I think even more important in this is the crisis that we have with our social housing lists as well, nationally. And the bank's decision came on the same day, Greg, that SIPTU, the trade union, set out a four-year plan it believes will solve the current social housing crisis and create 65,000 jobs. SIPTU said it's £3.7 billion plan to resolve the housing crisis by 2018 would create 25,000 social housing units and create 65,000 construction jobs. Now that sounds wonderful, but in reality, will that work? We know that we are facing a huge crisis in terms of social housing. We are looking at families that are being made homeless by the day. The government's response is extremely poor. If you're looking at the timelines on a lot of this, I mean, some families would have to wait up until 2018 in order to have a home available for them. We know that our county councils and their funding has dropped significantly. This is a real national crisis with regard to social housing units. So I think there's that aspect of it as well, which the government has not really looked
at. Well, it has. It's released a new, it's working close with NAMA. NAMA is releasing some property for social housing. There was quite a significant amount of funding released into Donegal to allocate, I think, a further 50 or 70 houses, you know, funding to allow the council bring but a lot of the council's problems come from water rates. And, you know, you're criticising the government, but it's your government Fianna Fáil, who you seem to think may be the saviours of the situation, they signed off on water rates.
Well, let me just add, I do not think Fianna Fáil are the saviour of the situation. I want to make that very, very clear,
Sinn Féin, then? Well, you're criticising the government. I presume not.
I'm criticising the government because they're in power, Greg. It is their function
That's old school politics, and their responsibility. You're a young person. You're talking about young persons being in politics. The blame game's boring now.
But they're in power. They have the control, Greg. That's the reality of the situation. It's not a blame game. It's just stating the situation and the facts as they are. Mm. You have Fine Gael and Labour. They are in power. They have control. They work out the budgets. They're the ones that work out the policy. They're the one that puts this into legislation that becomes reality for people on the ground. And actually, talking about water charges, that was my next story. So I shall move on to that next. Now,
do you see what I did there? I think you call that a segue.
Yeah, very clever. Now, this story has been in the media for quite a few days, and there is a huge amount of anger out there as water charges within Ireland are now seen to be the highest within Europe. I think, Greg, looking at this is, from my point of view anyway, is the story changes weekly. The amount changes weekly. We're getting no clear, concise costs on how much water we will be charged for. We're getting no clear plan.
It's about $260 a month.
We got different prices before the local elections. That's what I want to point out. This is changing all the time. So from next March, houses with meters will pay based on their consumption of water. Just one third of those houses, Greg, are expected to have meters. Now, everyone else will continue to pay an assessed charge. An unmetered household with one adult will be charged roughly €176 a year for drinking water, and wastewater services with each additional person over 18 paying €102 extra. Now, these costs are different to what we were told before the election.
What kind of feels a bit new to me too is we're paying for, if you don't have a septic tank, water going out of the house.
Yes, yes, this is the other thing as well. And it's very confusing for the public because it's changing all of the time. So again, back to your point, the charge is halved if only one service is used. If you have a septic tank or a private well, you will only pay for one service. So how is that done? How will they come out to check this? How will it be assessed? How will it be regulated?
My biggest concern in all of this is that, you know, there's people listening onto this programme today that their water is undrinkable, right? Mm-hmm. Now, for the first 3 months, they'll pay half price. So if you can't drink your water, you're still going to have to pay half the rate. And after 3 months, if the problem hasn't been resolved, then it's free. Now, what people have kind of got a shock about here is what, by international standards, is deemed drinking water, water that's fit for human consumption. Because I can tell you, it's going to be cloudy, it's going to be messy, and you're going to be told, look, you can drink that, but there's not a chance that anyone's going to be able to drink that. So the amount of people that will be able to avail of this half-price water, or indeed this free water after 3 months, I think is going to be minuscule. Because the standard for what's fit for consumer consumption is incredibly low.
Absolutely. And at the moment, around 23,000 people across the country cannot drink their water. And homes and places where the water is unfit for that human consumption will get a discount. Now, as you say, how much will that discount be? Who's going to look at this quality of the water? Well, you may famously remember Luke Ming Flanagan bringing across that glass of water across the Dáil Chamber, if you remember that, Greg, where he wanted to point it out, the serious condition of the water in Roscommon. Again, there seems to be no direction on this. It seems to be very confusing for the public. Now, I have to say, the Irish Independent...
Your party signed this on. I can't let that go, because you are having quite a pop at this government. Do you feel bad about that? That this is all because Fianna Fáil in their agreements with the bailout said, right, well, we are going to bring in water charges. And then I hear people from the party saying how bad it is and it's all been done wrong. It probably wouldn't have happened if you guys hadn't signed up for it.
Well, let's just be honest here now for a moment. The government...
Hold on, yeah, I'm going to start recording this. Go on.
The government is in place, Greg, and they actually make the decisions with regard to the tariffs, to the consumption, to the payment, how much we will be charged. We were looking at Irish Water, who had wasted something in the region of €80 million on consultancy fees. So from that aspect, we're just looking at value for money for the Irish consumer and the citizen and the taxpayer. That's very, very important to point out. Water charges are going to be extremely difficult for families that are on the brink, that are struggling to pay for for their food on a weekly basis, and now water charges on top of that. It is harrowing to see what some families are going through. It is really, really awful. I'm not here to defend Fianna Fáil. I'm here just to present the facts as they are appearing in the newspapers this week. And one of the big issues is water charges for families. And what we actually have, Greg, is the information is not clear. It's not concise. It's changing constantly. Irish Water seem to be very difficult to get in contact. I know that from a number of public representatives when they've gone to sort out issues. It is a very, very difficult situation.
Well, that's because the public, or local public representatives don't seem to understand the structure here. You know, they go to the council makes the representations to Irish Water. Irish Water have said very clearly, and I certainly am not defending them, that they can't take individual queries from councillors. So if your councillor is out there telling you, I'm contacting Irish Water on your behalf, well, then they're blowing hot air, because Irish Water have said quite clearly, and on this programme, that they don't take representations directly from councillors. A caller says, there's no talk of the people who can't pay point blank pay it. Your general cost of living, there's no talk of this. We're asked to pay all these taxes. This isn't going to work. The politicians aren't in touch with the people on the ground. Their wages need to be reduced instead of charges charging us tax. That's like the argument of walk 1 week in my shoes. And it'd be interesting to see people do that. Another one says, a Fianna Fáil person picking stories up in an attempt to make the government look bad. Is this really happening? Well, that's what I'm here for, to try and offer a little bit of balance on that. Claudia, you say you're not, but you know, you can't help it.
Greg, I'm only picking out the stories that are in the newspaper. Okay. Water charges are everywhere. This is in every newspaper during the week, and it's back in the newspaper again today. I'm not here to pick at the government. I'm not here to defend Fianna Fáil. That is certainly not what I'm here for. Simply to review what is in the newspapers. This is in every national newspaper, and indeed within our local newspapers during the week as well. This is a huge issue for
massive
families.
It's absolutely a real huge issue. I mean, it's the straw, you know, that broke the camel's back for many people. And you know, a lot of people are connected up to major watering systems and networks in the likes of Letterkenny and other major towns. But a lot of us have septic tanks and all, and there's an awful lot of cost involved in that. And that is also coming down the line.
Absolutely.
But unfortunately, time is going so quick. We'll move off the water issue, if you don't mind, Claudia.
Okay, no problem at all. So next, I am going to move on to the Irish Examiner.
Well, now, there's a lot of rail stories which we can brush straight over,
yes,
can't we?
Well, actually, I'm going to come to this because it's on the front page today. GAA fans face travel chaos as rail workers time stoppages for finals. GAA fans are in the line of fire as rail workers draw plans for a 3 work stoppages over 4 days in response to moves by Éireann Rothéireann to cut pay. The National Bus and Rail Workers Union is planning a 48-hour work stoppage starting on Sunday, August the 24th, which will coincide with the All-Ireland Senior Football semi-final in Croke Park. There is a possibility of Cork and Kerry being pitted against each other. Now, the union's plans follow-up action include a 24-hour stoppage on both September the 7th, Greg, and the 21st, the dates for the All-Ireland Senior Hurling and Football Finals respectively. Now, indeed, according to the unions, the planned stoppages were on days which would dilute the impact on the general public. I find that hard to believe. Éireann Rothéireann wants temporary pay cuts ranging from 1.7% to 6.1% to secure the viability of the company, it said. Indeed, the union got an 80% mandate, Greg, in a recent ballot for industrial action from their members, so I think that's quite important.
I wonder, are they playing ball, hardball? I mean, that's what you do first and foremost, isn't it? You lay down the threat of strikes, and that you hope you can bring your employees to the table.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure there's a great is there a great deal of public sympathy for the likes of these workers. A lot of these companies, you know, over the past have been perhaps you know, not run as good as they could have been, and people had wages that perhaps, you know, they can't be paid now, whereas it wasn't so bad in the boom. But obviously this is going to be a conversation that's going to have to resolve this situation, because...
Absolutely. And just to say, we've all taken pay cuts in our pay as well. It's not simply the employees of Éireann Rothéireann, and we're all suffering and we're all having to budget and tighten our belts. So it's a national issue for us. Now, the General Secretary, Dermot O'Leary, said the option of an all-out strike had been set aside for now. So I think when you talk in terms of bargaining and hardball, I think that's the one that they're putting down at the very end of the road. But definitely, there needs to be negotiations.
It'll end up in the LRC and be resolved, really, won't it?
I hope so. I hope that actually happens. Absolutely.
And anything else?
Now, we're going to move on to a few of the local stories, Greg. I thought that was important to look at our local newspapers of the week. One story that has been carried in a lot of the Donegal newspapers is callous car thieves target graveyard. So what we have been reading about is a number of cars have been robbed outside graveyards and during masses.
And Garda Sergeant Paul Wallace in our crime spot, he's coming back on with us 2 weeks ago. He went out of his way, and I know everyone's not listening, and I certainly am not that arrogant, but went out of his way to say, this is exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are still leaving goods sitting out on the in view and what have you, and we know that these callous people will target cars even at graveyards. Here we go again. Even though the warnings are out there, even though it happens year on year, we're still, and I've, listen, in fact, I could tell you I've made the mistake right now. I probably should go out and address that in case anyone's listening. We do leave valuable goods sitting out in the open in our cars.
We do.
Carry on with what you were saying as it relates to the story generally, Claudia.
Well, really, again, I suppose it's just coming back to giving the public those tips of how to stay safe and what to do. And it's really at this time of the year when people are on holiday, both locally and nationally, that you actually forget to do these things. So what he's actually saying is, lock your handbag in the boot, put the valuables in the boot, perhaps don't bring them with you. Local Garda Sergeant Siobhan Mullen is up, quoted here in the newspaper as well as saying, it's preventable crime by locking your valuables in the boot, mm-hmm. or better still, leaving them at home. It's a crime that causes a lot of personal upset and stress, in particular to females if their handbag is taken, as they usually contain a lot of personal items like their keys and purse.
And the last picture of a loved one, a mom or a granny, it's amazing. And I can understand how people carry it around with them.
Absolutely.
Photocopy it. Take the photocopy with you and keep the original nice and safe. One you want to raise with us, Claudia, if you don't mind.
Yes, now this is a very important one, and it's in relation to ambulances in Donegal and the time delay for them actually getting to very serious accidents. And really now, this could be a matter of life and death for a lot of people. So I'm just going through here to the newspaper. This actually happened up in Buncrana, where a lady had fallen off her bicycle. Mm-hmm. She had injured herself, and they had to wait up to 45 minutes for an ambulance to get to her. Now, thank God it wasn't too serious, and she was okay, and the ambulance got there, and they could look after her and give her the medical care that was required. However, that time delay is very, very serious and significant. God forbid if it was something more serious, it could have been fatal. So it's something that needs to be addressed, particularly, I think, with the Department of Health. We do not have enough ambulances within the county of Donegal, and I think people forget about the geography and the size of our county. So I think we have one ambulance based up in Carindona for the Sinishowen area. The delay was very significant, 45 minutes, and it's something that needs to be addressed nationally.
And indeed, you know, reports have found, and not least in our own county, the absolute tragic consequences of such a thing. Claudia, mm-hmm. Time has caught up on us, unfortunately. It's been fantastic having you in, and you will be a future guest, I hope.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely, Greg. I'll be delighted to do
Claudia,
so.
Fianna Fáil's Claudia Kennedy.
I'm here to present the facts. I want to make that very clear.
I don't know how they train you, because it's coming out on you. But anyway, listen, it's no harm. That's what we do. We mixed up. Yeah. We had Labour last week. And I'm sure we'll mix it up down the line. Everyone has a political point of view at this stage, don't they? But listen, Claudia, I'm only teasing you a little bit about that. You've been very
it's
good,
okay,
and rather balanced. Listen, thanks so much for coming in, and we'll chat to you again. Claudia Kennedy there. And now keep your calls and comments coming in, please. They're coming in thick and fast. Very much appreciated. 086 77 00 555 is the text line. Or you can call us on right now on 074 91 25 000. Caller wants to raise the issue of Donegal's next game. It's live here on Highland Radio, of course, for those of you who wish to listen to it with us, and so many of you do, and it's very much appreciated. But this caller wonders why Donegal fans are not up in arms about next week's game being only live on Sky Sports. Do people not realise this, or have they given up and accepted that this is how it's going to be from now on? So, yep, that's where it's going to be. What's your views on that? 086 77 00 555, or call us on 074 91 25 000. On the issue of water, I'm glad water tax came in. I dug my own well at my expense, and all along I was paying to provide other people with water through my tax. Well, you are in a great position, aren't you, with your well, because your water is going to be free, but you will be charged if your water goes into the mains, so to speak, I believe. And there's loads coming in on the Vox Pops. We're going to get to that very, very shortly. And also coming up between now and 11 o'clock, our reporter Barry White. Well, it's a year since those awful floods down at Letterkenny General Hospital. And so many of us are affected either directly or indirectly by Letterkenny General Hospital and the work that's gone on over the last year to try and get things back up and running and improved. It's a lovely piece. It's a coming up to you for you between now and 11. But just before the break, and maybe you can text in what your views on some of this is. Yvonne McFadden's been out on the streets once again. Some of the issues are serious, some not so. Free education is one of the questions. What people's views are on paying for water, and when, if at all, are you too old for miniskirts, tattoos, guys in skinny jeans and other types of things? Have a listen and have your say. 086 77 00 555.
Do you think there's such a thing as free education?
No.
And why is that?
Because you have to pay for everything now for children, including copybooks, pencils, crayons. Okay.
And what do you think about the water charges that is coming in now?
That's a disgrace. They're charging to wash yourself. For a drink of water, they're going to charge you.
You should be charged for some. Okay. But it's probably unfair, the amount that they're going to charge.
Do you worry about paying water charges?
Yes.
Very much so.
Do you think it's fair?
No. Simply because it should be free. Like, if it's been free for as long, then why should you be having to pay for it now? Like, it's not fair that they're needing to get more money, but they're taking it from people, especially if there's a lot of unemployed people, then there's things hard enough as it is without worrying about water charges.
So. How old is too old for the likes of miniskirts or tattoos, do you think?
I think it has to be down to the individual.
Okay.
Whatever floats your boat, I suppose.
Over 40. Yeah, over 40.
Over 40. Yeah. Should definitely not be worn after that age.
No, definitely not.
It's happening. But there isn't an age on it.
Up to the individual?
Yeah, the individual, yeah.
Okay. And what about yourself?
I think if you've got the legs to wear a miniskirt, wear it.
How old do you think is too old for miniskirts for women?
Well, I still wear them when I'm 52.
Great. And from a man's perspective?
25. Now, you're very welcome back to the programme. Some of your texts coming in on the Vox Pops there. Greg, if a woman has confidence and most of all legs to wear a mini, then do it. For me, skirts above the knee haven't been worn since I hit 40. As for tattoos, women shouldn't have them. They look cheap. No matter how cute the tattoo is, a woman shouldn't have them, full stop. And that is coming in from a woman. Tattoos, obviously all the rage at the moment. They are permanent. And some people love them, some people loathe them. But it's the individual's own body, isn't it? But everyone's entitled to their opinion. So this lady stopped wearing them since she hit 40. Well, Greg, I'm a lady who's nearly 63 and I wear skinny jeans. Mutton dressed as lamb, maybe. Ah, not at all. But she goes on to say, but what the heck, I'm happy and that's what, that's all that matters. And so true, you know, we worry so much sometimes about what other people think and who cares, really? You have to think sometimes, don't you? It's about how you feel yourself. 086 77 00 555. Keep your texts coming in. You can call the programme, 07491 25000. Or if you wish to tweet, you can tweet either at Highland Radio or at Greg Hughes 2. I'm on Twitter. Follow me, I'll follow you back. That's how it goes, isn't it? Right, 12 minutes to 11. As I mentioned, it's a year now, just over a year, since those floods devastated Letterkenny General Hospital. Barry White went down to the hospital this week to see how things have been progressing. He compiled this report.
Letterkenny General Hospital has been severely flooded. All patients have
This year marks 1 week since the flood that devastated Letterkenny General Hospital. I was there that night reporting when the hospital was hit after 1 hour of torrential rain. I remember parts of the ground floor being covered in water. It was up around your ankles. But it wasn't just normal water. This was water coming through overflowing sewers with bits of toilet paper and excretion floating through it. On the first floor, the walls were leaking with gushing water. And in other areas, pieces of machinery worth hundreds of thousands of euro were destroyed. It was clear to everyone in the hospital that night that this was a catastrophe. Well, 1 year later, I'm back at the hospital to meet with the hospital manager to see what progress has been made.
Hi, Sean, how are you?
Barry, welcome to Letterkenny General Hospital. Back again 12 months on. You were here with us in the middle of the chaos of the night of the flood. Hopefully, as we go around, you'll see some of the progress we've made since then and some of the challenges we're still facing.
Okay, sure, we'll take a walk around.
Okay. The worst disaster in Irish hospital history. Bear in mind, all our power's gone, our phones are gone, our electricity is gone. There were certain things we were lucky with. We were lucky that it was a July evening, that despite the rain, it wasn't, you know, the middle of winter, it wasn't freezing, people weren't sort of becoming hypothermic with the cold. It was a long evening, it stayed brightly, 11 o'clock at night. It gave us the opportunity to get the backup generators going and get power supplies re-established. The fact that we had some parts of the hospital that had been vacated that were available to us that we could decant into made it more possible. And there's a lot of things could have been worse.
And do you feel it could have been worse, looking back now?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
And at this stage, 1 year on, can it be estimated just how much damage was done?
Construction costs alone will be in excess of 25 million and somewhere probably between 25 and 30 million euro. Equipment replacement and then the costs of having to provide services off-site, again, will mean the total bill will be well over 40 million euro. So it's a huge financial impact, huge. It's interesting, I was talking to somebody socially recently who's very big into kayaking. And they were talking about having 40 centimetres within an 8-hour period to swell the river they were kayaking on, sufficient to make it really exciting and challenging. If 40 in an 8-hour period can swell a large river, imagine what 47 in a 1-hour period does to stream like the Sprackburn. Interestingly, that's just, you see my text come in here. If you have a monitored alarm system that measures the water on the on the Sprackburn continually, and if the water level rises and changes quite significantly, alarms off to certain key people as an electronic warning, and every morning at 10 o'clock it sends me a text to tell me that it's still functioning effectively. It's like a check test to ensure that the system's operating effectively.
Will this new Sprackburn guarantee that we won't have a disaster like we had last year ever again?
I suppose it's the James Bond film Never Say Never. I don't think anything guaranteed given some of this very bizarre and strange weather that we've had. But I'm guaranteed by the two engineering reports that we've had undertaken is that it has the capacity to cope with events that would be 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000 year events. That short of some sort of major typhoon, it'll cope with virtually any foreseeable level of rainfall.
And in this part of the hospital, as we can see, there is quite a lot of workmen here, and there is quite a lot of work going on.
There's a lot of work going on. We're actually back out of the service yard. You see the emergency department there. So again, I suppose to give us some context, remember this is the service yard, the water flowed into one of the early areas. So again, the water, as you can imagine, was at its highest here, was flowing in very, very fast, coming downhill, under speed, and rushing very, very fast. This is the mortuary area here, and this is the link corridor down to the mental health unit. The areas, again, you can see the raised areas were sealed off. These were the areas where the old pharmacy was, and they were, again, some of those were wooden frame buildings which were completely devastated with the flood. So while there's a lot of work going on here, there's still a huge project to be undertaken.
And how long will this work take to finish here? We see the workmen here, and this, how long will it take?
This area will be finished in the next 2 to 3 months. So by September, October, we'll have this area open and pathology moved over. And so this area will be functioning within the hospital. But the area beyond those doors won't. That is functioning will have stopped functioning, and the work will be going on in that area. And that work will continue to the end of the year, and the building I said needs to be replaced with the brick building. That will be probably into May, June next year before that's all completed.
So as I said a few times there, Sean, that people probably don't realise that there is still quite a bit of work to do.
There's a huge amount of work to do, and we've got over 15 projects. We've got about 4 of them completed, and another four underway at the moment. But there's still a number of projects that are still very much at the design stage. The staff are doing brilliant, but it's still working in suboptimal arrangements. That impacts on your efficiency, that impacts on the ability to expand and take on more workload if the hospital gets busier. So we're trying to rebuild the hospital and run a hospital all at the same time. And again, I suppose one of the things I would say is that, the times we do have pressures in our beds, if the times that we do have lengthy waits for tests or appointments, I would ask the local community to be patient with us and to understand that while you may drive up the front and think everything is back to normal, as you can see here today, there's still huge parts of the hospital that are unavailable to us and where there's still construction work either underway or yet to be done. And over the next 12-18 months, month on month, we will see continued improvements in terms of getting those areas re-established.
And so do you still foresee then that there will be still a couple of years building work or rebuilding to do?
It's going to be spring, summer of 2016 at the earliest before all this is completed. And it's been an extremely busy year since we reopened. We've had a large number of emergency admissions, a lot of very elderly patients, a lot of patients with what we call comorbidities, several things wrong with them. So it's not, people aren't just coming in with one simple condition, but they may be coming in with chronic chest pain, but they may also have problems with their diabetes, they may have problems with their mobility, etc. So there's a lot of patients that have required significant medical and clinical input and rehabilitation. That means the patients stay with us longer, and if your bed complement is reduced, that means that you're going to take the next patients coming in into the hospital is reduced and delays occur. And we've seen that, and we've seen that very significantly with the amounts of patients waiting on trolleys to get in hospital.
And we often hear that in the past year, since the flood, we've heard that overcrowding has been a problem. And how much did the flooding last year, how much of a role has that played?
A very significant role, because you see how much of the hospital is still unavailable.
So when the works fully completed it in 2016, do you feel that it will be a better facility than it was prior to the flood?
Oh, without a doubt.
By 2016, when it's all finished and complete, how much do you think will have been spent?
Well, as I say, at the moment, the estimates are in excess of 40 million, about 43 million. But there's still work going on.
Today was my first time back at the hospital since the flooding last year. And although there is still a lot of work to be done, it's a wholly different picture to the one I had in my head. It's clear to see the significant progress has been made. In the wake of the flooding last year, it was hard to foresee the hospital getting back to anywhere near normal. They are getting there, but it is also clear that there is still a lot of work to be done. Many areas are still closed off and are months, even years away from completion. But management and staff are confident that by spring 2016, the facility will be better than it ever was, which was truly unthinkable in the aftermath of the flood.
You're very welcome back to the programme. A caller says, I'm disgusted with RTE for not showing Donegal's GAA game on Sunday next in Croke Park. We pay our TV licence and are entitled to see the game on RTV. Some people can't get to Croke Park or can't afford to go, nor can they afford Sky, from a very annoyed listener.